Starting from the gloom of a four-month COVID-19 lockdown, most Britons are now free to hug, albeit cautiously, visit their pub, sit down to an indoor meal, or visit the cinema. Freedom beckons once more. There is excitement.
I'm happy that I could go to the movies again, you know, because it's just been like you're running out of things to do.
We've just had a lovely lunch, first time in all those months inside a restaurant. It felt good.
But beside the euphoria, there is also anxiety, the emergence of the Indian variant of COVID-19.
I'm told that if it's only marginally more transmissible, we can continue more or less as planned. But if the variant is significantly more transmissible, we're likely to face some hard choices.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Perhaps the toughest of those choices, another lockdown. Some scientists, among them the government's chief medical officer, have warned of a summer surge in cases.
All the modelling suggests there is going to be a further surge, and that will find the people who either have not been vaccinated or where the vaccine's not worked.
So far, nearly 70% of Britons over the age of 18 have been offered their first dose of the vaccine, with the government saying the country is in a race between the vaccination program and the virus, especially the new variant first found in India that's been surging in several areas across England.
So will there be another lockdown? Boris Johnson has called the lockdown roadmap cautious but irreversible. And last month he came under fire for allegedly saying, let the bodies pile on high in their thousands, after reluctantly approving a second England-wide lockdown late last year.
It'd be obviously disappointing, but I would say not entirely unexpected, to be honest.
Steps need to be taken to deal with it. And if that means additional vaccination surges in areas where it exists, or local lockdowns, or nationwide, or travel restrictions, then my belief is that those should be brought in.
The UK's official death toll is nearly 128,000, Europe's highest figure and the world's fifth largest, after the United States, Brazil, India, and Mexico. And the possible outbreak of the Indian variant is sure to upset the Johnson government's roadmap out of lockdown. Saeed Puriza, London.
The families of the victims of the recent deadly attack near a school in Kabul called for proper attention to be paid to those affected by the incident. The families put the casualties at 90 deaths and over 240 wounded, all students. They also called on the international community, the UN and human rights bodies to probe the brutal attack. Referring to repeated targeting of Shia people by terrorist groups in Afghanistan, they also urged the international bodies to officially confirm the systematic genocide of Shia people in the country.
The attack on Sayyid al-Shuhada school came after a series of targeted attacks on Shia religious sites, educational centers, and sports clubs. It's a genocide, and we want the government and international bodies to officially confirm Shia genocide in Afghanistan.
But as observers say, it seems that neither terrorist attacks nor political obstacles can push back the determined young generation of Afghanistan, as they are fully committed to go forward in order to build their own country by relying on knowledge instead of war and violence.
The government has not yet fulfilled its obligation to protect us. The recent attack on innocent schoolgirls was a big tragedy, and such incidents must be stopped in the future. The enemy must know that we will go forward despite the challenges.
It was in the afternoon of May 8 when three back-to-back blasts rocked western Kabul, and many fasting residents of the area witnessed how dozens of schoolgirls were hit by these blasts. Although the Taliban has denied any involvement in the attack, but none of other terrorist groups, including Daesh, has claimed responsibility too. Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has emphasized on the need for a practical step from the government. President Ghani has already ordered a thorough probe into the attack and has called on his government to work on a plan to boost the security in Kabul. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands of Yemenis headed to the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a to express solidarity with the Palestinians on the Gaza Strip facing the Israeli relentless lethal bombing campaigns.
The Yemeni people have shown that the issue of Palestine is their red line. They have always voiced their support for the Palestinian cause. The Yemenis believe that Palestine is a sacred land and the occupation must come to an end at any cost. Yemenis crave for jihad in Palestine, even though Yemen is subjected to a brutal war for 7 years now.
Protesters blame the U.S. as complicit in the Israeli war crimes against the women and the children of the besieged Gaza Strip. They urge the Palestinian resistance groups to carry out further retaliatory rocket attacks against Israel.
Yemen is stance has been renewed along with the growing strength of Palestinian resistance in the Gaza. The massive march confirms that the Yemenis stand by our side against the Israeli occupation. We salute the Yemeni people for their steadfast support despite being involved in a deadly war and siege for years.
Yemenis have also lambasted countries, some Arab states, for normalizing their relations with Israel. They said it is a great betrayal to all Muslims around the world.
It is clear that the normalization of relations with Israel is aimed at obtaining the praise of America and Israel. But the aggression happening today against the people of Gaza reveals the extent of their betrayal of the Palestinian cause and all Muslims.
Israel has renewed its attacks on the Gaza Strip and the West Bank in what has become the heaviest war against Palestinians over the past 7 years.
Holding up Palestinian flags, people here voice their solidarity with the Palestinian cause. They say the international community should hold Israel accountable for its war crimes and continued violation of the international law. Yad Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Started a normalization phase after 3 weeks of lockdown. A 15-day long period of eased but not lifted restrictions has started in the country as daily numbers of new infected started falling. Due to the measures taken during the holy month of Ramadan, the numbers decreased from 60,000 per day to something near 10,000. Turkish president said the country hoped to overcome this pandemic as the new waves across the world has badly affected the situation in Turkey. He also stressed the importance of taking the vaccine to overcome this phase so that Turkey could go back to normal life soon.
Normalleşme adımlarını atıyoruz.
We start implementing our normalization calendar as of Monday. The restrictions will be eased in phases until the end of May and significantly as of June.
Experts say that the gradual normalization would not result in another increase in the numbers of daily infections. They also advise citizens to minimize their home visits to relatives and friends, as well as stay away from shopping malls and crowded areas.
The number of daily infection cases has reached a logical point, paving the way for easing the lockdown. We need to ease the lockdown to make a balance between containing the spread of the virus and allowing our people to go back to work and get prepared to welcome tourists. Our economy has been negatively affected with the lockdowns over the past year. We are trying to continue with the vaccination campaign. The government is now trying to get more vaccine jabs.
Most of the travel restrictions will be lifted, but nighttime and weekend curfews will remain in place, and restaurants will only open for food deliveries. With the new measures, Turkey hopes to compensate the economic losses it sustained over the past year. If tourists don't return to Turkish beaches this year, the nation's current account balance and lira are likely to be hit. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In a rare show of strength, the opposition parties and the government joined hands in Pakistan's parliament to pass a unanimous resolution or what it said, unending war crimes against unarmed Palestinians by Israel. The parliament called on a 57-member bloc of Muslim countries, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, to now undertake decisive steps to bring an end to ongoing unilateral war against innocent Palestinians. However, not very far from the parliament, the anti-Israeli protesters are not willing to trust OIC, given its track record of failures. The protests in Pakistan are expanding given the relentless bombing by Israel, killing Palestinians since last week when Israel imposed unilateral war on Gaza after it attacked the third holiest site of Islam in the occupied eastern Jerusalem.
If their anger is not being expressed by the leadership of the Islamic world, I think they will go on their own. And I believe that an Arab Spring is about to restart. And this Arab Spring is not going to just remain to the Arab boundaries, but it will even come to Pakistan and beyond.
We want action against ISIS!
These are Pakistani journalists. They are at pain over a growing scale of violence against international media networks and journalists in occupied Palestine by apartheid state of Israel. They protested and observed Black Day against Israel for killing innocent Palestinians and bombarding commercial infrastructure housing international media networks and Palestinian residents. International Federation of Journalists and Political Analysts point out that the frequency of the incidents with which journalists have been attacked with potentially a lethal force in the occupied Palestine indicates about the existence of a formal official policy to silence the media networks and journalists who are struggling hard to document the war crimes of Zionist state. However, so far, Israel has enjoyed impunity from all the war crimes it has committed against the unarmed Palestinian, given the fact it enjoys unconditional support from the US and other NATO allies in the Europe.
It only goes to show that the American moral power and European moral ascendancy also has limits. They are fast losing their moral authority to lecture the world on human rights.
More protests are planned on Friday when the clerics in hundreds of thousands of mosques and Islamic schools are expected to make anti-Israel speeches. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
and Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. The second week of Israeli aggression on Palestinian territories, sophisticated ordnance has claimed more than 210 Palestinian lives, almost half of them women and children. Palestinian resistance groups are also performing retaliatory attacks on Tel Aviv and other Israeli targets. They insist they will keep raiding Israel as long as Gaza and other Palestinian areas are coming under heavy Israeli land, navy, and air raids. On this debate show, we'll explore various aspects of the escalation with our panelists. Let's first go to our own correspondent in Gaza City, Ashraf Shannon, and see what update he has for us there. Ashraf, over to you.
The number of fatalities in the Gaza Strip because of the ongoing Israeli atrocities has risen to 213, and over 1,500 people have been injured, and as Yavir mentioned, nearly half of them are children and women, and also large numbers of elderly people, and there are at least a dozen doctors and teachers and people from all professions were killed in this ongoing onslaught since 9 days ago. Israel continues to pound the enclave, the Israeli Navy, gunboats, Israeli tanks, Israeli warplanes, using all kinds of weapons to attack over 2 million Palestinian civilians in the enclave. All the targets, or actually most of the targets that have been hit in Gaza by the Israeli regime forces were civilian buildings and civilian infrastructure. Israel bombed at least three buildings known to house media companies, although dozens of other buildings also that were targeted had journalists in them. The health situation has reached a very critical point. The Ministry of Health is appealing for aid and surgical supplies to help take care of the wounded, especially amid of the coronavirus pandemic.
All right, thank you for that update, Ashraf Shannon in Gaza City. Take good care of yourself, Ashraf. Now, joining me are a couple of guests. We'll have historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers out of Hasselt, Belgium. Also, international coordinator with the Samirian Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, is joining us from Vancouver. Good to have you both on the show. Beginning with Belgium, Brecht, Israel continues to pound Gaza. More than 200 Palestinians have been killed. So how do you size up this latest Israeli war on Palestinians, which is now in its second week?
Well, unfortunately, it is not a unique situation in as far as we're talking about, of course, Zionist attacks on Gaza and on the Palestinian people and the Palestinian nation in general. This has been part and parcel, of course, of the Zionist entity and the Zionist project since the very start, since 1948, and this has only gotten worse, of course, after the war of 1967 and ever since. And unfortunately, we have seen time and again in the last 20, 30 years that despite continuous diplomatical attempts and attempts at negotiations, that every so often there is a major war happening from the Zionist entity against Palestinian targets, especially very often tied to matters such as Israeli elections, whenever they need to get domestic attention away from internal problems, they turn on Palestinians, which is, of course, a victim that they always are more than willing to attack. Now, the difference, why this is, in a way, in a unique situation, is that the resistance and the resilience of the Palestinian people, which has always been very admirable and very successful in the fact that they continue to resist and continue to exist as a resilient and resistant people. But this resistance has kicked up a few notches, I think, in the past week or the past 9 days, in which you see not just the typical retaliation, but very, very precise and very successful retaliatory attacks. We have had missiles land in Tel Aviv, missiles land in near the Dimona nuclear weapons facility that Israel maintains in the Negev Desert. We have seen now reports surfacing of the Israeli Zionist offshore oil and gas platforms being targeted by remote control submarines. And now, of course, in the latest reports, we see that the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which is the armed wing of Fatah in Ramallah, is starting to also, you know, take up arms and call for all-out revolutionary struggle. This is basically, I would call it, a third intifada forming and building up all across the Palestinian nation, which is a very hopeful symbol and a very hopeful signal that real lasting change and liberty to Palestine could indeed be around the corner, especially when you think about the fact that so far all of this resistance has been purely domestic. There has not yet been external support directly from Lebanon or from Syria, for example. Right. When this kicked off, the situation could get even could change even faster.
Now over to Vancouver, Charlotte. The Biden administration just approved a $735 million arms sale to Israel. What's the U.S. role? How big a role does the U.S. have in this Israeli onslaught against the Palestinians?
Well, the U.S. has a major role in the Israeli attack on the Palestinian people. And I mean, this, again, is also something that's not new. When Palestinians are fighting back against Zionist bombs and weaponry and the Israeli war machine, they're also confronting the full might and power of U.S. imperialism. And so it really shows that in many ways the Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance are protecting humanity on the front lines. When we look at the U.S., every single year, the U.S. provides $3.8 billion a year in aid to Israel, and this aid is military aid. This is aid that is directly aimed at funding and supporting the Zionist war machine that is attacking Palestinians, occupying Palestinian land, and engaging in settler colonialism. If we look back from the beginning of the Zionist project, the Israeli state, the Israeli entity, was always seen as essentially kind of an aircraft carrier for imperialism, whether that was British colonialism or U.S. imperialism. And today, the U.S. is fully responsible for these crimes that are taking place, for the massacres that are taking place in Gaza. And that's why it is so important for people in the United States to take action, to demonstrate, to organize, to build the boycott movement, and to hold political officials accountable and make it clear that all U.S. aid to Israel must stop immediately and that sanctions must be imposed on the Israeli entity.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bresht, the United States says also that this is not the only thing that it has done. It's also blocked the U.N. Security Council meeting or any action or statement on the Israeli war on Gaza. We had the Palestinian envoy to the UN just an hour ago in a presser there. He said that they tried so hard, there were consensus. There was only one country, meaning the U.S., that has stopped this meeting from happening. Now they're asking for a General Assembly meeting and all that, and a lot of countries are supporting it. So, and the U.S., he said that they promised to do something undercover to stop this Israeli aggression, but that didn't happen either.
Yeah, well, no, of course, this is a very, it's when I read the information and the developments of the United States intervention in the UN Security Council and trying to block any and all, even theoretical condemnation, even if it's just verbal, just in words, condemnation of the Zionist aggression. Again, this is unfortunately nothing new and unfortunately nothing shocking, but at the same time, that's why I say it's a bit of a double story, because at the same time, in terms of, especially when we're talking about Palestine and about the oppression by of the Palestinians by Zionism, the United Nations has very often been somewhat of a paper tiger, a toothless lion, so to say, in which they have never really done much to really help the Palestinian people. In fact, unfortunately, it was one of the first acts that the United Nations took as an organization was the creation of the Zionist entity on the top of Palestine. Of course, back then, this was with a very limited amount of membership, which was mostly dominated by the West. But still, and even ever since then, the United Nations has, of course, denounced, after the war of 1967, the Zionist illegal settlements in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem and on Gaza, and the occupation of the Sinai and the Golan Heights. But when push comes to shove, there has been very little work done by the United Nations, and one of the major reasons for that being, of course, the undemocratic functioning of the United Nations Security Council, in which one permanent member can block everything. Even if the entire world were to unite in the United Nations, the United States alone could still block this with its veto power. And the same goes for France and the United Kingdom, who are also two major pillars of Zionism in Europe. So this is it's an unfortunate situation to be in, and that's why I feel bad in a way for the Palestinian representatives in the United Nations, because some of these diplomats are probably very sincere believers in the negotiated solution, but they are getting slapped over and over again with the impossibility of their job and the impossibility of their mission. And I believe that in the end, you will see, as has been shown so often in the past, in times of when dealing with oppression, when dealing with imperialism and colonialism, is that the only option to solve this is resistance. Even in terms of South Africa, mm-hmm. which for a major part was indeed where apartheid was brought down by international pressure, this international pressure only came as a result of decades of internal resistance and revolutionary struggle led by people such as Nelson Mandela. Only after that, after 20, 30 years of resistance, the United Nations and the international community finally decided to step in and impose sanctions. But this is very, very unlikely, unfortunately, to be done, these sanctions to be applied on Israel. So at this point, I pin my hopes not so much on the UN, but on the internal resistance of the Palestinian people that will, in the end, put the Zionists or the fact that they will have no option but to pack their bags and leave.
Okay. Now, Charlotte, what's your perspective on this? I mean, the responsibility of international organizations, UN being one of them, and also that of the international community. in the midst of all this savagery that we're witnessing against the Palestinians.
Yes, well, I mean, it's very unfortunate to note that, you know, it's certainly in recent years and much to date, the United Nations has been effectively blocked or controlled or dominated by the United States and fellow imperialist powers, especially in Europe and Canada and elsewhere. That being said, it's absolutely necessary on a popular level for people around the world. And if we look at the streets of, you know, every major city, and not just major city, but small towns and villages around the world, we're seeing tens and hundreds of thousands and even millions of people globally taking to the streets and carrying the Palestinian flag as a symbol of humanity, resistance, solidarity, in justice over injustice. And so when we see these massive demonstrations everywhere around the world standing with Palestine, that what we need to do is to translate that sentiment and that solidarity into action and into accountability. And that means struggling and organizing in the United States, in Europe, in Canada, in Australia, elsewhere, to do everything that we can to tie the hands of imperialism and struggle within the belly of the beast to stop these crimes that are taking place against the Palestinian people. That's one reason why, I mean, when we say boycott Israel, yeah, this is just a kind of a small action for individuals to take. But the more the international isolation of Israel grows, the more that we are able to provide real and meaningful support to the Palestinian resistance, who are the actors that are actually making this victory of the Palestinian people possible. And so when we talk about boycott, demonstrating, organizing, we're not talking about an alternative to the resistance. We're talking about the international support that is important to support this Palestinian, Arab, and international struggle for justice and accountability. And that includes holding accountable the United Nations and the representatives that are refusing to take action and are allowing massacres to continue to be perpetuated against the Palestinian people. And despite the fact that there are pages and pages and pages of UN resolutions on Palestine that have never been implemented, and that essentially the United States forced the withdrawal of the resolution recognizing that Zionism is racism, the fact is that Zionism is racism, and this has been recognized by the vast majority of the world. And the fact is that Palestinians have the right to resist, have the right to engage in armed struggle, just like all colonized people fighting occupation and oppression. And this has been recognized. This is a fundamental part of international law. And so applying international law in Palestine means supporting Palestinian resistance. It means supporting the liberation of Palestine, and it means putting an end to colonialism.
Okay. Now, Breshta, regarding this worldwide condemnation of Tel Aviv and its aggression against Palestinians growing, and Charlotte just mentioned a number of the instances, rallies in support of Palestinians all over the world, even in the Western world, in Europe, in Paris, Rome, elsewhere, in U.S., San Francisco, Washington, Boston, elsewhere. You had people out there, and this is getting louder and louder. And does this mean, is this an indication of, let's call it a PR defeat for Tel Aviv and Washington's agenda for the Palestinians?
I think we're definitely seeing a change. We're not quite there yet, I believe, because of course the Hasbara agenda, the agenda of Zionist and then the practice of Zionist propaganda is still extremely strong, and they influence, they have a huge influence on the political system, in especially in Western Europe and North America. And they continue, of course, to have a very active social media presence that still spreads a lot of misinformation. But indeed, as indeed has been said by the other guest, there is a growing amount of activism. And indeed, not just in the bigger cities, but also in the small towns. We were speaking, for example, here in Belgium, even smaller towns, just places with a couple of thousand inhabitants, have their own small rallies pro-Palestine coming up also in the coming few days. So these are rallies of people who, in many cases, these are people who never really participated much in let's say, in long-standing pro-Palestine or anti-Zionist campaign. These are people who are not necessarily ideologically committed to any specific ideology, but they feel deep down that there is a great and grave injustice being done. Of course, when I say we're not quite there yet, there is still a lot of work that needs to be done, because there still remains a major, idea that still exists in the West of a, let's quote-unquote, both sides are bad, that idea in which they believe that both sides should put down their arms and negotiate, which is a very idealistic way of thinking, considering that they've been trying, the Palestinians have been trying for the past 73 years, and it hasn't really gotten them anywhere. Mm-hmm. But still, the fact that people start to understand that a certain form of resistance is logical, that a certain form of rebellion and revolutionary sentiment of the Palestinian people is a logical next step to take, and that Israel needs to back off and needs to withdraw and needs to basically needs to pedal back on its idea of establishing a ethno-state for what they consider to be the Jewish race. There is a lot of popular sentiment nowadays that says, you know, this sort of ethno-state system is not of this time. It is not something that we can accept any longer. It is in violation of international law, of common human decency. So when I see that happening, that fills me with a certain sense of optimism that a lot of people across the West, they defy their political leaders, because all across Western Europe, with the possible exception of Ireland, the political elite is staunchly pro-Zionist, including here in Belgium. There have been constant apologetics for the bombing of Gaza, constant misinformation campaigns trying to blame everything on Hamas. But the people are starting to get fed up with these lies and start to get fed up with these, let's say, these idiotic attempts to justify mass murder. That's when you see people come to terms with the fact that this is a struggle not just against Israel in particular, but that it's part of a wider anti-imperialist struggle, anti-colonial struggle, that is part of a the modern society, if right. you want the country to be independent and to be free. So okay. that is why I believe, as has been said, that this is it's an hopeful development that I hope will continue in the near future.
Okay. We have only 1 minute left, Charlotte. Let's also take a look at the way that some Arab states have acted. They not only remained, they kept their deafening silence against all these atrocities by the Tel Aviv regime. They even turned their back, and they normalized, they kind of signed that so-called normalization deals with the Tel Aviv regime. What makes them do that? We have only 1 minute.
Unfortunately, many reactionary Arab regimes are in the pocket of U.S. imperialism, but I think that one thing is very clear. This current uprising is putting an end once and for all to the project of Arab normalization with Israel. It once again, they believed that they would be able to pass this, that they would be able to elevate their collaboration to a public level against Palestine. But what has happened is this situation is redirecting the compass of the region towards Palestine and towards liberation and towards confrontation of Zionism and imperialism against all of the attempts to alter the situation, to instead force Arabs to fight against one another in the interest of imperialism. People are recognizing the real enemy and the real struggle that has to be fought, and normalization and the project of normalization is on the road to its ultimate defeat.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and contribution. Historian and journalist Bryce Jonkers in Hassel, Belgium. International coordinator with the Summit on Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates in Vancouver, joined us with their contribution and insight. Top in your host, Behrouz Magic.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com irib.org/en.
In the limelight.
Studies have shown that climate change is supercharging some weather and climate events and will lead to more severe and longer-lasting heat waves, stronger hurricanes, an increased wildfire risk, and a longer wildfire season. American people can also expect more heavy rain events and severe droughts, not to mention other extreme events like February's polar vortex. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Tara Lohan under the heading "Climate-driven extreme weather is imperiling wildlife conservation efforts in US." The article has been taken from the truthout.org website. Storm in southern Texas, tornadoes in Tennessee, wildfires across the western United States, a barrage of Gulf Coast hurricanes. Those are among the record 22 weather and climate disasters that each topped $1 billion in damages last year in the United States. In all, the price tag for 2020 hit a whopping $95 billion, and that's just in the United States. Reinsurance firm Swiss Re put global economic losses at $175 billion last year, including $32 billion for floods in China and $13 billion in damages from Cyclone Amphan across India and Bangladesh. The worst news? Americans' profligate burning of fossil fuels means they're in store for more of this. Studies show that climate change is supercharging some weather and climate events and will lead to more severe and longer-lasting heat waves, stronger hurricanes, an increased wildlife risk, and a longer wildfire season. American people can also expect more heavy rain events and more severe droughts, not to mention other extreme events like last February's polar vortex. Bruce Stein, chief scientist and associate vice president at the National Wildlife Federation, says, "You can't attribute any particular storm to climate change, but what we do know is that climate change tips the odds of making many of these events more severe." While experts tabulate the economic losses, homes destroyed, crops ruined, businesses shuttered, the ecosystems and wildlife can also sustain damage that's harder to quantify. Bruce Stein says many plants and wildlife evolved with and have adapted to dealing with large-scale disturbances, but we're beginning to see mega-disturbances at levels beyond what we saw in the past. And that can take a toll. Extreme weather can kill animals directly or indirectly, like by destroying food sources, contaminating water, or altering habitat, forcing a species to move into areas where there may be more competition, fewer resources, are at greater risk of predation. The effects of climate change on the natural world are being felt at two speeds. One is more gradual, referred to by scientists as ramping, shrinking glaciers, rising sea levels. The second is quick, like extreme weather events. Sean Maxwell, a postdoctoral research fellow at University of Queensland's Centre for Biodiversity and Conservation Science, says both are problematic. But he adds, I think the changes to acute events have the greatest potential to devastate local populations or ecosystems, and the impacts of these events are often more difficult to plan for or to avoid. Sean Maxwell was the lead author of a 2018 study published in the journal Diversity and Distributions that examined how changes in the frequency and intensity of extreme weather and climate events affected wildlife. The researchers looked at 519 studies of ecological responses to extreme events, including cyclones, droughts, floods, and heat waves and cold waves, that took place from 1941 to 2015. They found that the response was negative 57% of the time, and in those instances where species benefited, they were mostly invasive species. Sean Maxwell says, some of the negative responses we found were quite concerning, including more than 100 cases of dramatic population declines and 31 cases of local population extinction following an extreme event, adding, populations of critically endangered bird species in Hawaii, such as the palia, have been annihilated due to drought, and populations of lizard species have been wiped out due to cyclones in the Bahamas. The researchers found plant species had the highest number of negative responses to extreme events, followed by reptiles and amphibians. The researchers concluded, collectively, the studies in our review suggest that extreme weather and climate events have profound implications for species and ecosystem management. Species that are already threatened or endangered are, of course, specially at risk. Take the Atwater prairie chicken, for example. A million of these birds once ranged across the prairies of Texas and Louisiana. Today, fewer than 100 remain in the wild, and scientists have sought to bolster their populations with captive breeding programs. But when Hurricane Harvey walloped Texas with 130-mile-per-hour winds, and record rainfall in 2017, the birds were right in harm's way. Other species with limited ranges, like those in islands, also face big threats. In 2017, Hurricane Maria cut the population of just 200 Puerto Rican parrots in half. The year before, Hurricane Matthew was believed to have wiped out the last Bahama nuthatches, or Sitta insularis. According to Diana Bell, a professor of conservation biology at the University of East Anglia in Britain, it took 2 years before a few of the birds were found, and then Hurricane Dorian struck in 2019, making their survival unlikely. Diana Bell wrote in an essay for The Conservation, in fact, Hurricane Dorian may have not only sealed the fate of the nuthatch, but also severely impacted other birds endemic to these islands, particularly the Bahama warbler and the Abaco parrot, adding, also known as the Bahama Amazon parrot, this subspecies uniquely nests in limestone cavities underground, which are likely to have been flooded by the storm surge. The risk to wildlife from extreme storms can be compounded by the ramping effects of climate change too. In other places, extreme weather is an extra blow to species already struggling with other environmental pressures, like habitat loss, invasive species, or pollution. Last year, the world watched in horror as land use management, climate change, and drought helped push Australia's bushfires to a terrifying new level, killing 34 people and burning 37,500 square miles. In the immediate aftermath, one expert put the death toll for wildlife at 1 billion animals lost. Since then, the figure has been revised to 3 billion killed or displaced by the wildfires. A study published in Nature Ecology and Evolution found that the fire impacted the critical habitat of 832 native species, with 70 species losing more than 30% of their natural range. 21 of those were already at risk of extinction. Those that survived could find themselves hard-pressed in future climate disasters. Australia already has one of the highest extinction rates, and the wildfires could limit the capacity of some species to recover in Australia, like the endangered kangaroo island, Donart, and the long-footed potoroo, and threaten others. The study in Nature Ecology and Evolution found Australia's record blazes last year could push the number of endangered species in the country up by 19%. When Hurricane Irma sacked the Florida Keys in 2017, the storm tossed boats ashore and destroyed more than 1,000 homes and left a trail of debris across the islands. It also endangered one of the region's beloved endemic species, the tiny key deer, which today primarily lives on Big Pine Key. Some deer were killed in the storm, and surviving animals face threats to their already limited freshwater supply as the storm surge dumped saline ocean water into the freshwater pools. Island residents responded the way folks often do after a disaster. They offered help to their neighbors. Following Australia's bushfires last year, the country's government jumped to the aid of wildlife by dropping 4,000 pounds of carrots and sweet potatoes to starving brush-tailed rock wallabies who lost the food source in the wildfires. But beyond immediate food and water relief, there's a much bigger task ahead. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions to address the ongoing dangers of climate change and the ability of ecosystems to adapt. For example, Florida Key deer also face a long-term threat to their drinking water supply from rising seas, something no number of kiddie pools can repair. And more severe hurricanes are likely in future as well. Sean Maxwell says, as climate change continues to ensure extreme climate and weather events are more and more common, we now need to act to ensure species have the best chance to survive. Adding, wherever possible, high quality and intact habitat areas should be retained, as these are the places where species are most resilient to increasing exposure to extreme events. His study found if such intact habitats doesn't exist, ecological restoration efforts can be used to help species adapt, and the more we know, the better. The researchers of the 2018 paper concluded, incorporating extreme events into climate change vulnerability assessments and adaptation plans will be challenging, adding, but by doing so, we have a greater chance of arriving at conservation interventions that truly address the full range of climate change impacts, and that could give more species a fighting chance in a changing climate.
Good morning.
morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.